understand anatomy and physiology. And then when it came to picking specialty, I went with my gut and I said, all right, this is something that I'd love to know more about, like psychiatry, because it is the most invasive field of medicine, if you think about it. People think that maybe it's surgery. I ended up attending a psychiatrist that would tell me that, just remember that this is going to be the most invasive field of medicine, in a sense that people trust you with their deepest and darkest secrets. They will tell you things that they have never said before.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's show. So this is a show I'm really hoping can help people who are confused about medication, because psychiatric medication can be one of the most misunderstood and emotionally loaded parts of mental health treatment, especially when we're talking about children, teens, and eating disorders. There is so much fear, so much misinformation, and so many questions about safety, timing, and whether medication helps at all. So in today's episode, I have a great guest. I'm talking with Dr. Payman Tashkandi, who is a double board certified psychiatrist who works with children, adolescents, and adults, and brings a very grounded, deeply human perspective to this conversation. We're gonna unpack how these decisions are made, why treatment should never be one size fits all, and what families need to know when the stakes feel especially high. This is, a wonderful conversation. And if you have confusion or concerns, I really hope that the content in today's episode really helps you. So I'm going to go get our guest and get into it. All right, Dr. Tashkandi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me here.
All right. So I like to know a little bit about guests in terms of how they got into the field. If you don't mind, would you just share a little bit with us about how you got into this and how you got to the place you are in your career now?
All right. Sure. Definitely. When I was a kid, I always liked the big questions of life. Where do we go from here? What are we doing here? I asked a lot of why questions. Mm-hmm. And when I got into the age to go to college, I decided to study human behavior. So I studied sociology on a grand scale or macro scale. And then I got more interested in individuals, why we do what we do. And when I got into medical school, I decided that the reason that I went into medical school was to really understand human beings from a physiologic level, because I couldn't really fathom the fact that we can actually decipher between the body, mind, and physiology and not understand every component. And when I got into medical school, I got to understand the scientific background, what makes us who we are, understand anatomy and physiology. And then when it came to picking specialty, I went with my gut and I said, all right, this is something that I'd love to know more about, like psychiatry, because it is the most invasive field of medicine, if you think about it. People think that maybe it's surgery. I ended up attending a psychiatrist that would tell me that, just remember that this is going to be the most invasive field of medicine, in a sense that people trust you with their deepest and darkest secrets. They will tell you things that they have never said before. They get to be themselves. They get to be their authentic self, hopefully. And you are going to be someone who is going to listen to things that no one has ever listened to before. That's why I chose psychiatry. And then why child and adolescent psychiatry? Because I thought, how do I get to know a person deeper? And I decided that I really need to know their development. And when I started working with kids, I fell in love with the art of being a psychiatrist, of being able to communicate with individuals who have not yet developed the cognitive ability to understand the adult world. So here I am. And I am currently in private practice.
Okay. So did you start out in private practice, or was that also something that happened later on in your career?
When I got out of fellowship, I went in and worked in an underserved area. I was in Compton, California, Los Angeles, in Compton area. And I had the chance of building a medication management arm to an integrative behavioral clinic there. I was there for 2 years. I had a chance of really building the clinic, working with amazing individuals there. And another opportunity came up for me, and I became a director of a clinic that was doing interventional psychiatry. This is mainly transcranial magnetic stimulation and ketamine infusion therapy. I had a chance of doing that for a couple of years, and I learned a lot about, especially about like neuroplasticity, the role of psychedelics in psychiatry, the role of interventions such as use of magnetic stimulation for treatment-resistant depression. So I got to work with individuals who had mostly treatment-resistant cases. And it was difficult work, but it was highly rewarding in a sense that people were coming to you who have tried many things in the past and they did not get results. So I was there for 2 years. I oversaw the program, created their medication management arm, and helped them build their TMS arm. And after that, I decided to go into private practice and follow my heart and mostly see children and adolescents in my practice. I'm currently in practice in Beverly Hills. I have an office. I do see patients in person. I see them online. I see little kids until the age of 60 at this point. Yeah.
So I know a lot of parents are really worried about considering medication for their kids, and rightfully so, and I'm sure that in your practice. Sure. Is there anything when you're talking to parents in terms of like brain development and their concerns and things that you ask most frequently, or that their biggest concerns are? Maybe people listening are wondering for themselves, oh gosh, isn't that going to possibly do harm for my kids or have some kind of effect on their long-term brain development? I'm just curious what tends to come into your office.
Of course. Obviously, everything is going to be dependent on the case. I think it's very hard for you to find a child psychiatrist that is going to be medication heavy, because most of the training that you get, you come with this mindset that medicine is not going to be the initial treatment for this child, because you really want the patient to receive the lesser invasive treatments before you actually consider medication management. Now, everything is going to be condition dependent as well. Are we talking about depression? Are we talking about an eating disorder? Are we talking about ADHD? But when I talk to a parent from a standpoint of, okay, does your child need medication management or not? The way I approach is this. I will give them exact science behind it that we know so far, give them the data that we have so far, and I give them my options. And I put patients in three different categories. They're patients that I know for a fact that doing a medication management at this stage of their treatment is not going to be fruitful, or it's going to be too much, unnecessary. Then I have, on the other side of the spectrum, patients that I think absolutely they need medication right now, because I really need to target the physiology, because no amount of therapy or no amount of other therapeutics at this stage is going to be helpful. So those are on the other side of the spectrum. And you have a wide variety of patients that are going to fall in between, right? So the idea is that you present the case to the parent, you go over the risk, benefits, alternatives, pros and cons of every single thing, and then for that specific patient, for that specific time, you make a decision based on the data that you have. Now, having said that, medicines that we use in psychiatry are way better than what we had before. They have less side effects than what they had many years ago. They're more tolerable. Psychiatric drugs are actually being prescribed mostly by non-psychiatrists. Mostly primary care individuals or internists are prescribing psychiatric medications. Meaning that if you, for example, look at antidepressants are within the top five most prescribed medications in the world. If it's not top five, it's definitely in top 10. So this is data for a few years ago. Now, when I present the option of medicine to parents, I say, we can't classify the patient in which category they are. The ones that medication will be an overkill, the ones that absolutely they need medication because of the fact that if they don't, they will decompensate and it will be incredibly hazardous for their health. And then the in-between cases, those are individuals that they can wait. We can just do therapy initially and then, for example, add on medication. What type of medicine we're talking about. And then the other thing that is incredibly important is that, all right, is this medication going to be addictive? And is this medication going to be required to be taken for the rest of their lives? These are questions that I answer every single day. Now, depending on the medicines, the ones that we prescribe, let's put ADHD aside for a minute. Everything else, I would say majority of them are not addictive. And patients can come off of medications. And the idea is that they should come off of medication if the condition is in a way that you can take them off. The idea that I put somebody, let's say, we put somebody on antidepressants at the age of 14 and have the expectation they're going to take an SSRI for the rest of their life is an outdated idea. You know, studies show you start somebody, for example, in this case, on an antidepressant, have them take it for 9 months or a year, take them off. If they're doing great, they would never need to get back on. But what we know, for example, is that if someone has a depressive episode, and the likelihood of having another one is 50-50. If you have the second episode, the likelihood of having a third one is actually higher. And if you have three, the fourth one is much higher. So we know that about certain conditions, that the more they happen, they're more likely that they become lifelong conditions. To answer your question, yes. So we go over all of this. I actually spend a ton of my time with parents on psychoeducation because I think that, first of all, they have the right to know legally. Then they need to know their parents. And also, I want them to be in charge of making decisions because you want them to make the best decision for their children with the guidance from someone who's a professional. We're not in a business of forcing anything on anybody. There are very rare cases, that doesn't usually happen in an outpatient, that a physician thinks that a patient needs a treatment and the parents are not providing it, but those are rare. I don't see it in my practice. 9 out of 10, parents always want to do the right thing for their kids. And you talk to them, you get everybody involved, have a discussion, and make a decision. And at the end of the day, this is not a black and white answer. Things change. Diagnoses change. Conditions change. Environment changes. But in psychiatric disorders, environment plays a huge role, depending on the condition that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. You know, I get a lot of questions too, like how much do genetic histories of parents or families play a role in terms of... Yeah. The need for kids need to stay on, to your point, long-term, forever, if sure. You will. But, and so what do you talk to parents about in terms of that?
Sure. The most important thing when you talk about any psychiatric condition is this concept of complex versus complicated systems. Okay. And I know it's a little bit nerdy and it's a little bit cerebral, but bear with me. If I have a complicated system, meaning something that is very complicated to make. For example, this watch, let's say. It's a very complicated system to me because I'm not a watchmaker, right? Imagine that if I could learn all the pieces that go into this watch to make it work, and I learn everything about it, if it suddenly stops working, I can go you know, open it up, find what the problem is and fix it, and it will work. If I cannot do it, that means that I don't have the ability to do it, or I didn't learn it, or... But a complex system is a system that changes. It's a dynamic system. It has a feedback loop, it has feed-forward loops, it constantly grows and changes. Human body is a complex system. Human mind is a complex system. Psychiatry is the most complex system. The reason for that is that you have genetics, which is the blueprint that you were given or bestowed on by your parents. And then you have epigenetics, which is the role of environment in changing the genes that you have. You have the environment or society that you live in that includes your culture, religion, immediate family, school, partnership that you're in. And then you have your psyche, your mind, which is basically your beliefs about who you are, your understanding or worldview about things, your generalities, your cognition. And so therefore, we have this model of biopsychosocial, meaning that biology, psychology, and sociology, in addressing a patient who comes to me, for example, to receive psychiatric care. Now, genetics is part of a big part of the system. However, it changes from condition to condition. For example, we know with depression, close to 60% of depressive episodes are genetically inclined. Now, everybody, when you say genetics, the first thing they say is this: oh, you know what? My mom and dad never had depression. Okay, that's not what I mean. When we talk about genetics, is that you have the predisposition, meaning that your heart, your software in your DNA, you have the susceptibility, you're prone to be depressed. So these individuals who have those genes or cluster of genes end up having a depressive episode more likely happening to them if something bad happens to them. For example, we all know individuals that, for example, they've, let's say, served in a war, gone through divorce, have had multiple medical conditions and gone through crises, and it doesn't affect them at all. And then you have someone else who goes through a seemingly minor breakup, but it really affects them a lot, right? So now imagine that if your body was able to really take care of its quote-unquote chemicals in the brain in a way that it would replenish it after anything that would happen that was bad, the likelihood of that event to happen is lower. So that's essentially what I tell parents. And I say that, yeah, genetics play a role. And there are certain conditions that are highly genetic in a sense that it's just, unfortunately, the blueprint dictates a lot. And there are conditions that are not as much. But the good news about psychiatry and the good news about the brain is that we have this thing called neuroplasticity, that brain can change. Not change drastically in the sense that if I have, for example, ADHD today, I won't have it tomorrow, which we can talk about that later. But we can actually learn ways or coping skills and methods to deal with these things that we have. Now, neuroplasticity is going to be in effect full force when you're developing, when you're a kid. When you're an adult, yes, it's there. It's less so. The reason that we develop is because of the neuroplasticity, the ability for the brain to adapt and change. Therefore, we need to take advantage of that. But what I tell parents all the time is that the ones who are very much concerned about getting treatment early on, I say, the good news is that if you get treatment early on, you have the most ability to teach them coping skills and strategies that they can use in the future, because they're learning. They're like sponges. I mean, obviously, we're talking about different age ranges. It depends what age we're talking about, and the role of certain types of therapies are going to be different based on the age.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have these questions too in terms of, do we just need medication, or do you believe that there's a need for therapy and medication? Because I know sometimes people, it's always disheartening to me when someone goes to a psychiatrist or they're
pediatrician mm-hmm. or their primary care doctor gets medication, and they're like, okay, I don't need therapy now, I'm good.
Yeah.
Obviously, sure. I'm biased, but I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Okay. I tell you this. As a child and adolescent psychiatrist, basically I'm double-ported in adult and child, so I see everybody. But primarily now my focus is children and adolescents. So I'm going to call myself a child psychiatrist. Okay. If I see a psychiatrist or a clinician that is just telling parents that all you need to do is medication for your parent, I would say that maybe you should think about someone else. And in my field, there are not that many of us around. Almost most of child psychiatrists around are not trained that way. And they're incredible individuals. You know, I've always had a chance of working with them in my career. But the reality is that we understand that medicine is only going to be part of the puzzle. And it is going to, the way I usually tell parents is this, I say, I'm giving medication to soften the physiology or help the physiology to go in a direction that we want. But the therapy and hard work is going to be the most important piece. Because if you, let's say, if I have, let's say, anxiety, and I take a medication for anxiety, that's an anti-anxiety medication, SSRI, and it helps me tremendously with anxiety. But if I have a tendency of exaggerating threat, if I have a tendency of becoming overwhelmed when something negative happens and get anxious, if I don't learn the tools, the cognitive behavioral therapy tools that I can utilize, no matter what, yes, medicine decreases my physiologic response, but then my mind will wander and anxiety will still affect me. But if I utilize medicine, combine it with that therapy that we know it works, it's going to do wonders. Yes, medication plus therapy is going to be way more effective than either of those two alone for a lot of cases.
I just said that.
Of course, probably I'm one of those like therapy heavy psychiatrists. I do my own therapy, but I have decided that not to make that bulk of my practice just because my expertise is needed in the areas that they're not, as I mentioned before, there are not that many child and adolescent psychiatrists around. My expertise is needed elsewhere. But therapy is an essential part of treatment, no question asked.
Now, obviously, this podcast and my specialty is eating disorders, and
yes,
that can get very complicated, I think, with lots of things.
Sure. And
so, obviously worked with many psychiatrists in my career, but I'd love to hear some questions that I often get from, or ask you some questions I often get from parents and in working with just my patients in general. How do you manage when someone has like comorbid depression, anxiety, and say anorexia nervosa? And mm-hmm. what do you treat first in terms of if you were working with a teenager? Because I think my experience is it's really hard for the medication to be even digested or work if mm-hmm. somebody's not eating enough, or if maybe they're purging too, like mm-hmm. The medication might not stay in their system. So I'm just curious, sure. like how you manage all that.
Yeah. So it's a very good question, because eating disorders are going to be one of the more complex conditions in psychiatry, and they have the highest mortality rate. When I talk about eating disorders, it's very important for us to actually really touch on the medical issues that can come up from not treating them initially, and then get into how do you really manage it. So number one thing, when I see a patient with an eating disorder, the first question I have is that where are they in terms of their physiology? Okay. Has the eating disorder become to a point that it has affected their organs? So I really need to know, how's their heart? How are their intestines? If they're female, are they getting their periods? For how long they've lost it, if they have lost their periods? What are their electrolytes like? So the reason for that is that we know, for example, anorexia nervosa, when patients start losing weight, the loss of fat that is inside your body can cause your heart to go into arrhythmia, have low heart rate, you can have intestines that actually get together, and then you will have fistulas. There's going to be a connection from one part of the intestine to another. And usually when I see patients with eating disorders, this is the first, like, we call it a funeral session. We sit there with the parents, and we really tell them the action. I know I don't like that word, but I was trying to make it very difficult, very important for patients. And I say, if we really don't treat, this can be actually deadly. And I'm not even exaggerating, because amongst all of the psychiatric conditions that we have, the highest comorbidity and mortality is going to be someone who has an eating disorder, specifically anorexia nervosa. It's very difficult. People don't think about it that way, but it's true, because people can have significant medical complications that can really affect their health. Okay, so put that aside. We talk about that. So that means that I need another team member. Who do I need? And a primary care physician. So I need a pediatrician or internist. If they feel comfortable, great. They can do the cardiac workup. If not, a cardiologist. Right? So we get all of those like clearances, or make sure that where are you at in terms of your heart health? Where are you at in terms of your general physiologic condition? Check the electrolytes, because if electrolytes actually are out of range, it can cause seizures. And then, so therefore, I have to be very mindful of what medicines I give my patients, because if they have electrolyte imbalances, I cannot put them on medicines that can lower the seizure threshold. So there's so many things that go into that in terms of making decisions for the patient. So the first thing is make sure that you get a screening of how their health is at this time. And then the most important part in managing an eating disorder patient, in my opinion, have been that you give all of the treatments in conjunction with each other, and you move very quickly. We got to act fast. It's one of those things, I don't want to wait. I don't want for this patient to come back next year and now all of a sudden they're having so much medical issues that I need to stabilize them first. So I prefer usually for my patients to receive a comprehensive treatment at a facility, for example, PHP, like a partial hospitalization program, or IOP level part of program. But if they're fit for outpatient, yes, you can start the care in an outpatient world, but you need to have team members. So you have your psychiatrist, you have your therapist, then you have your internist, nutritionist. Everybody will work together to actually address the issues that they have. Medicines alone will never reverse any eating disorder. We have medications to help to ease the comorbidities, depression, anxiety, binge eating, for example. In binge eating disorders, impulsivity is a huge part of it. We do have, for example, lisdexamfetamine, which is a stimulant that is FDA approved for treatment of binge eating disorder. For example, we will address that in a binge eating patient. But an anorexic patient, it's a whole different story. You cannot utilize medicines that can suppress their appetite. So there's going to be a lot of factors involved in picking and choosing what type of treatment. Now, as the hardest part about treating patients with eating disorders, insight. If my patient doesn't have insight, it's going to be very difficult. If they have insight, and if then have willingness to actually work on it, then it's going to be a very different trajectory in terms of their treatment goes. Now, I tell parents that if I start somebody on a medicine to target comorbidities, it doesn't mean that this medicine is going to fix the eating disorder. They still need to really intensely get treatment for that, for their specific type of eating disorder.
A few more questions, right?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Notoriously, labs come back looking fine.
Sure, yeah.
How do you manage that? Because I find that across the board, like there's this false sense of I'm fine.
Yes.
My labs look quote unquote normal. Mm-hmm. And I know they're engaging in all sorts of very dangerous behaviors. And, the primary care doctors, pediatricians, like, and it's, and I know they're not doing all the labs that need to be done, because a lot of times they're not specialists in eating disorders, don't know all the labs to give the patient. And so, like, I will even send sometimes, do these ones, they're not done. So, again, there's this false sense of, everything's fine, or if somebody has atypical anorexia, that goes under the radar as well. They get misdiagnosed with binge eating disorder. That's not what they're struggling with. Or they get very told things that make it worse. So I'm wondering for you, what do you see in your practice? Do any of these things, do you see any of these things going on, and how do you manage those?
Yes. In my practice, I've just learned that I will encourage my patients to seek help from individuals or physicians in the community that are going to listen to them, listen to the other providers in the community. And you're right. Yes, they might not. Okay. Our threshold of risk is very different than another physician. So we really need to understand that the snapshot approach, in a sense that if someone's labs are fine today, their electrolytes can shift very dramatically as time goes by, because oftentimes with today, depending on how the body has been able to compensate for the changes, is going to be very different than a week from today. Therefore, there's this understanding that we have as a psychiatrist that, you know, what you present today is not going to be present tomorrow. So we get frequent labs rather than just one lab. Okay, number one. Number two, the most important thing is for us to think about what is going to do the most harm to this patient. So my mind always goes to the heart. I really need to make sure that their heart is okay. I do get frequent EKGs. I don't read the EKGs myself because I'm not a cardiologist. I'll have the cardiologist or internist read it, okay? Interpret it. I want them to tell me there's no arrhythmia. I want them to tell me that the QTC is fine. You know, those things that we know that can actually affect somebody who has an eating disorder. Now, if you look at it from this lens that, for example, if someone who participates in purging, right? Every time you vomit, and if you do it significantly, you're changing your physiology in a sense, right? So that lab that you showed me 2 months ago is not relevant today. So we need to redo it, okay? Yeah. And I understand the other physicians saying that this is fine. The reason they're saying fine is that they're just saying at this time it is fine. They're not saying that it's going to be fine. They're not saying that it was fine. So based on what I see, it's fine. And So we don't treat numbers, we treat people, right? But we get the numbers to actually make sure that they are okay. I've had, when I was at my previous clinic that I was directing, I had patients who were, a couple of patients that were incredibly affected by their eating disorder to a point that their heart rate was in the 37. And there was one modality of treatment that worked for them, which was the ketamine. And I had to really get on a call with the cardiologist and be like, hey, what do you think? And they're like, this is the only thing that helped. Let's just do it. And that was the thing. Worked for them. We don't treat patients based on just guidelines. We treat them based on who they are and what works for them. But you're right. Yes. Frequent observation in terms of labs is not only necessary, it's super important.
Do you find that there is a lack of knowledge of eating disorders in the medical field, like in primary care, pediatrics?
Yes. There's a lack of knowledge and also lack of motivation to treat eating disorders. Eating disorders are very difficult to treat because of all the support that you need from the different specialties. And the more specialists you need involved in the care, it's harder to coordinate that, right? They're more difficult, or there are more physicians who don't want to treat eating disorders because of the lack of insight on the part of the patient. And a lot of times patients don't want to come in to see you, right? They don't see you as an ally. So that in of itself is not very rewarding for a lot of patient physicians, unfortunately, that's the way it is. And there's going to be a lot of non-compliance with treatment on the part of the patients. And also, if you're relying on the insurance system, oh my goodness, good luck. Because, like, in order for you to get a patient into a hospital, you have to show that they are so severely affected by an eating disorder that they need to be hospitalized. And once they get hospitalized, the measure of how good they are is by the fact that, are they safe to get out of the hospital, which I understand it, don't get me wrong. So when they deem the patient safe to get out of the hospital, then after that, you know, if you cannot get them into a program, which is very difficult to find that program as well, depending on insurances. So you have these patients who are waiting for a long time, and at some point they might give up. So I think that insurance and the way that our healthcare system works is the biggest impediment. I do think that a lot of physicians do not have a lot of knowledge about it because they don't see it in their practice. And if they see an eating disorder diagnosis, a lot of them say, oh, this is just psychological. They don't even say psychiatric, they say psychological. And then the therapist sees the patient, they're like, oh my God, there are all these other things going on. And then you don't have a lot of psychiatrists that are treating patients with eating disorders. Put that together, there's not a lot of, yes, there's not a knowledge and there's not a lot of support compared to other conditions in mental health, I would say.
This is my frustration.
Of course.
Trying to find a psychiatrist, a primary care doctor, a pediatrician who's well-versed in eating disorders, yes, who wants to treat somebody, one of my patients, it's so hard. I even get patients calling me saying, do you work with any doctors that have any knowledge of eating disorders? And I have to say, I don't, which is really hard to say. I'd love to find more, especially in network. It's so hard.
Yeah.
Because I get worried. Are they going to prescribe them something that maybe be like Wellbutrin or something where, you know, they have ADHD and then not, like, let me ask you about that. If you have a patient who has ADHD, like truly has ADHD and an eating disorder, how do you manage that?
Yes. So the easiest one is if they have a binge eating disorder and they have ADHD, so you put them on stimulant. Great. You have a tremendous amount of data on that. Just interesting enough, one of the highlights of ADHD diagnosis is actually impulsive eating, which is not part of the diagnosis. It's not part of like DSM. But we do see it in practice a lot. Therefore, binging eating disorder is easy to treat. Anorexia and bulimia, but specifically anorexia nervosa, the real question is that is the deficit in cognition related to a primary ADHD, or is it because of malnutrition? That's number one. Number two, which medication do you choose? Most of the medicines in the stimulant category are not going to be a good fit because they're going to decrease the appetite, they're going to give these false sense of satiation, that is satiety that is going to be compounded on their desire not to eat. Therefore, no, it's not a good fit. We do have other medications involved. For example, you have atomoxetine, you have guanfacine. They're not going to be the best. They're not going to be as effective as a stimulant in terms of ADHD. But we can get you there. We can help you with the attention and concentration. But then the other question is that how much of a deficit are we talking about and how much is it affecting their functionality? Not everybody needs to be on heavy-duty medications for their ADHD, and not everybody needs medication every day. So understanding the severity of the ADHD is going to be super important. And for those individuals, learning coping skills and strategies that they can utilize to manage their ADHD is going to be more important than anybody else. I'll give an example. Even if you have, let's say, ADHD, you take medication for it, and it works well. But if you don't have time management skills, you're going to still have time management issues. So I'd rather this patient learn all those coping strategies on top of the treatment that they're getting.
And do you ever have to decide for yourself, does somebody actually have, if they don't come in with like previous diagnoses of ADHD and they're saying like, they believe they have that? Because I find a lot of, when I worked at a hospital, people were saying, oh, I have ADHD, and they were like seeking a stimulant, but really it's part of their eating disorder sure. if you will. And so I'm wondering if you ever run into that as well.
I do, but not as frequently. I guess it's because of the type of practice that I'm in, that I do not attract patients who are seeking medications. However, I would tell you that, yes, every time I see a patient, this is my style of practice, is that every time I see a patient, I do a rundown of all the relevant diagnoses and I do a comprehensive evaluation. So even if someone didn't ever have a diagnosis of, let's say, OCD, I still go through them. Really want to make sure that we haven't missed anything. So if you come to me and say, hey, I've been diagnosed with depression for 7 years, I want treatment, or I'm on this medication, can we just continue it? Sure, but let's do a comprehensive evaluation. So we do that, and you'll be surprised. Many times we find many other things that no one is aware of. For example, like OCD is, I find it that OCD is just frequently underdiagnosed in the community, especially in children and adolescents. They go years without getting the correct diagnosis, thinking that this is just how they are. And it comes to a point that really affects their life. And that's when they seek help. Now, yes, I do see, I do have to always look for other comorbidities. But then when you look at all the comorbidities, the question is that, all right, which one takes precedence at this time? So if someone has ADHD, for example, and an eating disorder takes precedence, it's not the ADHD. If someone has depression and eating disorder, you really need to address both simultaneously, specifically depression. Because if someone's depression is causing them to lose weight, because now all of a sudden they have decreased appetite because they cannot enjoy food even, on top of their eating disorder, that's like a recipe for disaster. So depending on the diagnosis, you decide which one takes precedence. And then after that diagnosis is targeted, then you move on to the next one. There's sometimes diagnoses that have to be targeted simultaneously. It becomes an art at that point because everyone's going to be very different in terms of their presentation and what conditions they have.
And one of the biggest things is interesting. I'll do a post out there. Do you know what's the biggest fear in going into treatment? And the biggest thing that comes up for medication is, fine, I'll go into treatment as long as I can't be on a medication that will make me gain weight. And there's this big fear in everybody of that.
Yes.
Do you get that question often?
All the time. Okay. Yes. There are some misconceptions about that. Not all medications in psychiatry will make you gain weight. There are conditions that as a result of the condition, you lose weight. You're depressed. You don't eat because you're sad and depressed. Obviously, you have atypical depression that these individuals eat more. You have a lot of patients who have anxiety or significant anxiety, and they have this like globus feeling in their throat. They can't eat. They don't eat. They don't have the appetite. You have eating disorders that patients don't eat as a result of the condition. Now, all of a sudden, if you reverse that, let's say, you have the patient who's super anxious and he or she is not eating, and now they're not anxious anymore. So they eat more. But naturally, they do gain weight. There's no question. Same thing for depression, same thing for eating disorder. Yeah. So we really need to disconnect this idea of weight gain and medicine from a standpoint of, yes, there are medicines that can have the side effect of weight gain, but it's not all just a medication. What they do is that they increase appetite. Is it increased because the condition is getting better, or is it increased because the medication is making you have higher appetite? There are medicines that absolutely increase appetite. That's why we always choose the right medicine for the right patient. And there are medicines for it that are not going to make them gain weight. There are medicines that will keep their weight neutral. If your condition is getting better and you're eating less or eating more, then that's a different story. Then we have to talk about self-control, or we have to talk about measures to actually increase intake in the individuals that don't have much appetite. For example, I do have patients with atypical depression. Their depression gets much better. All of a sudden, after that goes down and they're not eating, they're fine, but they're not eating, then you have to supplement or remind them that, hey, you gotta eat something. Like, they don't necessarily have any eating disorder. Yeah. Yes, that's a very good question. This question that comes up every single day, every day.
gets complicated.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, we could ask you so many questions. I'm sure so many things come up, right? As you said, it's complex.
Yes.
Every human is so different and has different things going on.
Sure.
But sure. I appreciate you fielding a lot of my questions because I know these are the things that typically come up.
Yeah.
See online, what I have in my office. I know you're in private practice, so
sure.
People do want to connect with you, do have questions, do want to consult, or do want to have you see their children or adolescent or themselves. How can they get in touch with you?
Yes. So they can call my office, 424-303-8188, or they can go on my website, www.drtashkandi.com, and I'll be happy to help them. I do provide in-person and telehealth appointments in California.
Are you on social media as well?
I am on social media. So I'm on Instagram, drtashkandi.com, Dr. Payman Tashkandi, just my full name. And I do have LinkedIn. The usual ones.
They're all in the show notes. Awesome. Any last final words before we end?
No, I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much for including me in your podcast. And you know what? As a psychiatrist, as a person who's been doing this for a while now, I understand that it's very difficult to take that initial step to get help. But do it. Just take the step.
It is hard, yeah. But once you do it, I've never had anybody look back and regret that they took the first steps.
Yes. It's going to be the hardest, but it's going to be fun. It's going to be better.
Well, thank you again so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please rate and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.